Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KABU program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Don Merrill, author of the book Pledge, the Public Radio Fund Drive. Don's a career journalist, writer, and broadcaster. He's been a producer and reporter for civilian and armed forces broadcasting, worked for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and was a public affairs specialist for the federal government, and you might have heard his work here on KABU. Don especially loves working in radio and has been an avid public radio listener and supporter, which led him to write Pledge. The book started as an inquiry into the origins and anatomy of the Pledge Drive, what's become a necessary piece of the funding for public and community radio stations. But in the course of researching and writing, Don's book grew beyond Pledge Drives and covers the origins of public radio, the similarities and differences between public and community radio stations, the internal workings of NPR and associated public radio networks such as PRX, PRI, APM, and APR, the rise and fall of public radio personalities, the struggle for funding and the high costs of taking that funding from the federal government and big corporations, and what might lie beyond pledge drives and the current state of public radio. As you can imagine, Pledge is a big book and an important one for public and community radio listeners. It's a pleasure to have Don with us now in the KABU studios to talk about it. Don Merrill, thanks for joining us today on Between the Covers.
Hi, Ken. God, when you read it like that, it's like, who wrote that? Who would go through all that work?
Well, it wasn't Ira Glass. Don, you got your start in radio while you were in the military, working for Armed Forces Broadcasting. How'd you first get involved, and was radio something you had a passion for before that?
I remember when I was probably, I don't know, four or five, we went on a field trip to a radio station in Columbus, Ohio called WVKO, and it was an African-American-run station, and it was one of the few African-American-run stations in Columbus and in Ohio at the time. And my class, I just remember this field trip, and I was with a bunch of little kids, and all I remember was seeing, you know, the top of a lot of little heads like mine. And I remember looking up into this glass box, and this guy was talking, and he was saying my name, and when I went home, my mom said she heard me on the radio, and I don't know, that image has always stuck in my head, and I think that's the memory I carry with me and have carried with me throughout my life in broadcasting. So I guess I was introduced to radio at a very early age.
And then what was your experience in the armed forces broadcasting? Were you on the air or in addition to writing for them and producing?
I was. I started out in radio. And then, what happened was when I joined the military, the first few years I was an administrative person. And being an administrative person, you get to read a lot of things. And one of the things I read was the Army Jobs Book, which for Army geeks out there, you know, is 635-200. So anyway, I was going through the book and I saw broadcast journalist. And there was no other job like it. And I read the parameters for it and you had to re-enlist for it. So my re-enlistment was coming up. I re-enlisted for it. You also had to send an audition tape to the school, which trained military journalists at the time. That school was the Defense Information School, known as DINFOS, at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana. It has since moved to Fort Huachuca, I think, in Arizona, or maybe it's even in Los Angeles now. I think it's at Fort Huachuca. But anyway, I had to send them a tape along with an application. And so then they sent me back a letter saying, you know, your voice has some issues, but it's workable. and so they accepted me. You had to have an acceptance letter before you could re-enlist for it. And so they sent me an acceptance letter. I presented my acceptance letter to the re-enlistment official and then re-enlisted and then went to Fort Benjamin Harrison and then started training as a DINFOS trained killer. For anybody out there who knows what that means, then you know what that means.
Now, I'm guessing that Armed Forces Broadcasting was fully funded, and there was no need then for pledge drives. So when did you first get exposed to the now ubiquitous pledge drive, and what were your thoughts when you first heard those?
When I was on my first assignment out of the United States, I was sent to the American Forces Korea Network, AFKN, in Seoul. AFKN was a countrywide network run by the military in Korea, although at the time they didn't call it South Korea, they called it the Republic of Korea for political reasons. And throughout the Republic of Korea. AFKN operated probably, I'm guessing, maybe six or seven affiliate stations. And I was at the network headquarters in Seoul. And for that and for about half my time there, I was on in radio. So radio is sort of like a training ground for people coming in for the first time. And so that's where I went. And I worked the overnight shift, just the worst shift you can have. I mean, you know, and just the worst shift you can have for a radio person. So anyway, it was a 12-hour shift. You know, probably about 4 hours of it was production, eight of it was on the air. And, you know, downloading feeds and stuff like that. So in the course of downloading the feeds, what I would hear is National Public Radio. NPR came on the air in 1971. And I was in Korea in 1979 to 1980. So by then, the headquarters that oversaw all of military broadcasting, which was at the time called the American Forces Radio and Television Service, they would get programming in the United States, and they would send it by satellite to military affiliates around the world. And the programming, of course, was tailored to whatever the host nation's sensitivities were. So, you know, some affiliates, some networks wouldn't get some shows because it might be
offensive
to the government, offensive to the cultural mores of the population. So, but in general, AFRTS sent programming to their network affiliates around the world, and one of the things that they sent was National Public Radio. So my responsibility overnight would be to download the live feed of NPR, and then make it available for the day. So it would be broadcast at, you know, whatever the regular time was for people who listened at that in that part of the world, so it'd be 4 o'clock or whatever. And I would hear the feed, you know, not with any pledge drive breaks, because the pledge drives were cut out, because, you know, you don't play pledge drives to military because they're not really an audience for domestic broadcasting.
Oh, right.
But what we would hear was inserted in place of where the pledge breaks were, or the asks for money would be command information, community relations, public affairs information for the military audience and their dependents. But that's the first time I heard that in those spaces there was actually asks for money. And
but you were spared actually listening.
We were spared, right. We didn't have to hear them.
Right.
Right.
Now, the book, or at least the subject matter, was something you were thinking about for many years. When you actually came back to the U.S. and started listening to the pledge drives and not just the spaces between programming, when and why did you decide to sit down and start researching and writing Pledge, the book?
Well, after I left the military, in the late 80s, and between the late 80s and probably 2013. You know, I'm a regular listener to public radio, an enjoyer of public radio, listened to a lot of public radio stations moving around from place to place. But the pledge drives came with it.
Yes.
And every place I went, three times a year, there would be a period of about a week at a time where for about 12 hours a day, about every 6 minutes, they would ask for money. And, you know, for someone who listens to public radio, if you've listened to commercial radio, it's sort of like it's a toss-up. Do you want to listen to that, or do you want to listen to 10 to 15 minutes of commercials throughout the entire hour on a commercial radio station? Or do you want to hear a block of 15 minutes worth of commercials and nothing else and then 45 minutes of music? I mean, for these stations that are trying to make money either through advertising or public radio, through pledge drives, they're limited. They have to make their money somehow, and that's one of the things I came to realize about in the book. Public radio, especially, is really kind of locked in. They have only so many places where they can get their money, and they have to do what they have to do to make the money.
And we'll talk about the funding a little later too in the interview.
But getting
where
back,
they get their money,
right? But getting back to your question. You know, I realized after I had been listening to these pledge drives for years and years and years, I don't know what snapped in my head, but something snapped probably around 2013 or 2014. I'm not sure what it was, and I thought, now is the time.
Now, the research for this book was intensive. Don, the bibliography at the end of the book alone takes up 170 pages. that's a lot of research. How and where did you start? And can you tell us about the breadth of your research, reading journal articles, listening to archived audio, doing your own interviews? You made a few requests for documents from the government through the Freedom of Information Act.
Right. Where to start? I think the first thing I started when I was writing the book was sort of laying out what I wanted the book to do. And I wanted to, what I really wanted to do was complain. I wanted to complain about pledge drives. I wanted to say how awful they were and how terrible they are and how annoying they are and how intrusive they are. And I wanted to just point my finger at public radio and say, stop it, stop it.
That was the original objective.
That was the original objective. It
that,
doesn't
that,
sound
that
very
changed,
noble.
Yes.
No, yeah, no, it changed. I grew up. After I had sort of laid out, you know, that very narrow, I started to sort of read about public radio and pledge drives. And then I read about how the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 came into existence.
Yeah, signed by LBJ.
Signed by LBJ. And what existed before that. And why the Public Broadcasting Act came into existence. And then what came to fill that void. PBS and NPR were created as part of the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 to sort of give Americans a reconnection to their cultural heritage, which is a great cultural heritage, but was being taken over by game shows. And it was the thing that Newton Minow complained about back in the 1960s when he said the vast wasteland. Americans
right.
were being, you know, sucked in by a vast wasteland of game shows and situation comedies. And so, I started reading about that and then about how National Public Radio was created to create programs to try to connect to that heritage. And then the networks that sprung up alongside of NPR and the nation stations that sprung up within NPR to sort of redistribute that same cultural heritage, to tell the stories that don't get told, you know, in local news, and to talk to people who don't get talked to, that will only get talked to when there is federal support, to reach out and find those people and talk to those people. Because a lot of the stories that you hear on National Public Radio or American Public Media are not stories that you would normally hear on the broadcast networks, because those are stories that are put together by the broadcasters to draw attention. And the stories on public radio, those stories are more, and community radio, those are stories that are more focused on the community or focused on how to the betterment of your community, the betterment of humanity, the expansion of learning and things like that. Commercial radio, commercial TV, that's not their mission. They don't have the responsibility to do that as much. Community radio and public radio does. And so that's why, you know, it was important for me to realize that as public radio expanded and as it grew and as it created mechanisms to self-sustain, I realized why it has to do what it has to do. And so that's how I got into that.
Yeah, and you cover all that in the book. So it really goes beyond the scope of the pledge drive. And that was something you started with as a spark for the book. But the book is much more now.
Yes.
Giving that history. Now, radio as a medium has been with us now for about 100 years or so. Surprisingly, at least to me, public radio in the U.S. has been around for about half that time. You mentioned starting in 1971, and you mentioned LBJ's signing the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. That was amazing to me because given all the current gridlock in Congress, how did something like this act get passed? How did it come about? You'd figure there'd be so much partisan divide over it.
Well, there were two things that, as I say in the book, the stars aligned. Partly, it happened because President Johnson's family had a lot of broadcast holdings in Texas.
Ah, so there was money at the basis there.
Well, maybe not money, but he knew the power of broadcasting.
Oh, okay.
And
so it wasn't kind of filling his own pockets,
right?
Or anything
no,
like
no.
That.
I don't believe that. I don't doubt that, you know, Johnson's family benefited from having broadcast holdings in Texas. But I also know that the former chairman of the FCC could not get a lot of the things he wanted to get done until Johnson became president. And then after Johnson became president, all of a sudden the FCC was granting Johnson a lot of freedom to help expand the role of the agency and to give broadcasting a higher priority, you know, in the legislative agenda. And something about I remember reading about how once his wife became head of some of the broadcast holdings, when he was able to remove himself, and his wife, Lady Bird, then was able to move into maybe an overseer position in some of those broadcast holdings, more money and more accommodation for broadcasting came about. So I don't doubt that Johnson becoming president had a lot to do with the Public Broadcasting Act being signed, but I also think him coming into power as president and the effect he had on the FCC helped not only commercial broadcasters, but also, as we can see, you know, community broadcasters and public broadcasting.
And LBJ had a way of persuading those who didn't necessarily agree with him.
He did. I forget what they called it. It was a technique that he had.
There's a whole multi-volume biography by Robert Caro, I think, that goes into LBJ's techniques. But he was effective.
Well, he was effective until he ran into Wilbur Mills. Because once Wilbur Mills found out what LBJ wanted for the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 and CPB, which was going to be the overseer of that, what CPB wanted was they wanted a way to raise money for themselves.
So, and that's the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Exactly, sorry. CPB wanted, they had a list of maybe a dozen things they wanted in order to be a self-sustaining entity. And two of the things they wanted was, one, they wanted to have some kind of excise tax on the manufacture of televisions so that they could always have an income stream where they wouldn't have to rely so much on government money. And the other thing was they wanted their board to be independent. They didn't want it to be under the oversight of the federal government. Well, Wilbur Mills, who I believe was the Ways and Means Committee chairman of the time, and he was from a southern state, I believe, he and Johnson had a conversation, and he said something to the effect of, well, Lyndon, you know that's not how things work here. You know, we want to have the final say. We want to have control over this thing. If you want it, then you've got to strike those two provisions that they want. And so Johnson had no choice in order to get the CPB.
Okay, so there was a compromise.
There was a compromise, right.
Now, Don, I think at this point we should define public radio a bit more clearly. You've mentioned NPR, public radio, community radio, commercial radio. You say in the book, though, that many people conflate the term public radio with NPR.
Right.
I know I do.
Right.
I tend to. Not now, after reading the book. But public radio extends beyond NPR, right?
Absolutely. Public radio is what the Corporation for Public Broadcasting oversees that was created by the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. It is a genre of radio which is funded by the government, overseen by CPB, and its responsibility is to create programming that is beneficial not only to a national audience, but individual affiliate stations serving their own local audiences. That is different from NPR. NPR is only one of four or five networks that exist and are overseen by CPB. But because NPR is the biggest one, and because NPR has been around the longest, people tend to confuse NPR with public radio, and they are not the same. There are four or five networks, as I said, and each network has its own personality. NPR, all things considered, NPR likes to consider itself a repository, like the go-to of news about the nation that is nonpartisan. But there's also American Public Media, which has programs like Marketplace and what used to be a Prairie Home Companion before it was before that show ended, and the new one geared toward young people called Live From Here with Chris Thule.
After
Garrison Keillor retired.
Right.
And then there's Public Radio Exchange, which is really kind of an innovation hub. And then there's Public Radio International, which tends to focus on news from overseas. So each of those networks is public radio.
Mm-hmm.
And each one focuses on a different aspect of the audience tastes. NPR has always benefited from the fact that people confuse NPR with public radio, and they don't go through a lot of effort to make that distinction.
it's in their best interest.
It's in their best interest, right, right.
Now, another very surprising thing I learned from the book, and now talking about NPR again, which started in 1971, you said it was started by what you described as, quote, mostly a collection of hippies from the counterculture, which is a lot like KABU, which started a few years earlier than that in 1968. So I'm wondering what happened. Even as early as 1974, NPR had All Things Considered and Morning Edition with hosts like Bob Edwards, Susan Stamberg, and I would not consider them hippies or counterculture.
Right, right.
Even by the loosest definition of those words.
Well, by 1974, NPR had a couple of hundred affiliates, and they were realizing that, you know, they really had to professionalize their operation. So when they started looking for a show that could be sort of like an anchor show that the affiliates could connect to and that could tie the network together and actually make it a network, they started looking for people who did have those radio chops. Susan Stamberg had experience. Bob Edwards had experience. And, you know, a lot of the people that they brought in were people who did end up being the ones who have been with NPR to this day. Scott Simon, you know, Cokie Roberts, of course, she just passed away. But a lot of these people, in fact, Cokie Roberts and Linda Wertheimer and Susan Stamberg and the legal correspondent, Nina Totenberg, they are known as the NPR mothers.
Yes.
Because they're the founding mothers.
And Susan Stamberg actually wrote a book that you quote in the, you cite in your book about the history of NPR and her experience.
And so NPR did start out as a sort of like a ragtag collection of people, but there were a few people sprinkled amongst them who ended up being the ones who really were the directors, the pointers for the organization.
Now, you mentioned some of those big names, and you know, Bob Edwards, Susan Stamberg, Nina Totenberg, Cokie Roberts, Scott Simon, who's still around. But again, another surprising fact in your book, NPR turned down two of the biggest public radio personalities and what became very popular shows, and that's Garrison Keillor and Prairie Home Companion, Ira Glass, and This American Life. As you say in Pledge, these decisions by NPR were significant failures.
Yes.
And possibly led to money problems that kind of resulted in the pledge drive?
Well, they may not have led to, but they contributed to. The problem with Garrison Keillor was that at the time, Bill Mankiewicz was the head of news for NPR. And he felt that, and that was it was at a time when NPR was going through a lot of financial problems because, as I said, I mean, it was a network that was still struggling.
And it was getting mostly government funding, and this was pre-pledge drive, so it wasn't getting any listener sponsorship.
Right. CPB was giving all of the money to run public radio to NPR, and then NPR would redistribute that money to its affiliates. So NPR really was shouldering the entire network by itself. At the time when Bill Kling, who was the producer of Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion.
And that was from Minnesota Public Radio.
That was from Minnesota Public Radio, right. Mm-hmm. When Garrison Keillor and Bill Kling approached NPR and Frank Mankiewicz to see if NPR wanted to pick up the show, Mankiewicz said no, in part because it was going to be another drain on NPR's budget, but in part because he just didn't like Kling. He didn't like Kling and he didn't like what NPR represented because NPR always saw itself as serious news and storytelling.
And Garrison Keillor was kind of non-serious storytelling.
Right. And Mankiewicz felt that the likes of Garrison Keillor was polluting NPR.
My, that's so very interesting.
And so he didn't want anything to do with
it. He was a hardliner.
Right. And then I describe in the book how, you know, one report was that Mankiewicz was apoplectic when he saw how fast Garrison Keillor was taking off after Kling created American Public Radio and Prairie Home Companion became one of many shows in his stable. Minnesota Public Radio was making all kinds of money, hand over fist. Meanwhile, NPR was, you know, really going from hand to mouth.
How were they making that money? Now, again, that was pre-pledge drive.
Bill Kling was an early example of public-private partnerships because what he did was he created, it was also at a time when Bill Kling created magazines to sell swag for the show.
Oh, you mentioned that in the book, like a Prairie Home Companion mug or t-shirt.
Right. He created Signal Magazine and Wireless Magazine. Those magazines are still around, by the way. NPR doesn't run them anymore. But at the time when he created them, he created them to help sell swag and help promote, you know, the show and his network. And those magazines ended up bringing a ton of money into NPR. But the problem is that money represented unrelated business income, which is something that the IRS does not like nonprofits. Like, it's sort of like if a nonprofit had a business, mm-hmm. right? The IRS doesn't like nonprofits to run businesses, to run for-profit businesses.
So how did they get around those guidelines,
well,
or laws?
They went right up to the line. Because how much UBI you're allowed to raise isn't really ever spelled out.
Uh-huh.
And so NPR kept pushing the line to raise as much UBI as it could get away with until the IRS at some point probably stepped in and said, okay, you're about to get yourself in big trouble here, which is why, you know, maybe a decade or so later, Bill Kling sold the magazines. He sold Wireless and he sold Signal because they were both under something called Rivertown Trading Company. And that was the company he created under which both magazines existed.
So he'd have less of a conflict with the IRS.
So he'd have less of a conflict, yes.
Now, that very first drive, I want to get to that. And I think in the book you mentioned it was called Drive to Survive.
That was the second drive.
Oh, that was the second one.
Yeah.
Drive to Survive was 1981. What was the first one?
Well, maybe the second one was called Drive to Survive. What I know is that the first drive was instituted because NPR had come so close to going dark that CPB seized its public radio satellite system because they were afraid that NPR wasn't going to pay back the money, and so they gave it a $9 million grant at the very last minute, and in exchange, they said, "Okay, well, we want your satellite system because we know that you're going to pay us back if we're holding that." And so,
So they had collateral, so NPR had to raise some money in a hurry.
Right. And so after that, then that year, I think after the NPR got the loan, then they launched the first pledge drive, pleading for money directly through the affiliates to the listening audience for the network, not for the affiliate stations. And that's called bypass, when a network asks for listener money directly instead of allowing the listeners to give the money to the affiliates for their operating expenses as the affiliates would prefer.
For example, it would go to NPR and it wouldn't go to an affiliate like OPB.
Exactly. Okay. And so they were able to clear out some of the debt that way. And then the next year, they asked the affiliates if they could do it again. Fewer of the affiliates agreed, but some did, and so they were allowed to let them do. They were allowed to do that, which helped them clear out more of their debt. NPR seems to be in a financial crisis about every 10 years, for some reason. And you know, those two pledge drives were really one of the first examples that the affiliates got for how they could be bypassed by the network. And as I'm sure we'll talk, as technology has improved, that opportunity for bypassing has gotten better and better.
Oh, yes. I wanted to get into that a little later, Don. Now, that first pledge drive and the first two even, they still persist, pledge drives, obviously. You write in the book that 40% of public radio's funding comes from listeners. Where is the rest of the money coming from?
It's a basket. And I talk about that, the public radio basket. There's so many sources of income. It's almost like having a diversified portfolio. It's good that it's diversified, but it's bad because it means that, you know, you never really know when any one of those individual funding streams are going to be affected by outside forces or dry up or whatever.
And those outside forces can be big
Congress.
Corporate underwriters and big government like
right,
Congress. And,
right.
And that would determine or might limit the stories they can cover or how they cover them?
That could be. I mean, you could have a funder, for instance, I talk in the book about DuPont. And at the time, DuPont was funding a children's program on TV. It's called
Newton's Apple.
Newton's
I
Apple.
Got that down here, right?
Right.
And Newton's Apple wanted to do a show on chemical pollution.
Right, right.
But good luck, huh?
Right. Yeah, DuPont said no.
And it didn't happen.
No, it didn't
So there was nobody really standing up to DuPont at PBS at the time.
That's right.
public radio, of course, is not just an American thing. You're writing the book that 49 countries across the globe have it. How are those stations funded? I would guess they don't have pledge drives there, huh?
Well, I don't know exactly what they have, but I do know that a lot of the stations overseas have lots of government support. Like, for instance, I talk specifically about the BBC and the CBC. Mm-hmm. The BBC is totally funded by the government.
And that's the British government, and CBC is Canadian.
Right. Mm-hmm. The BBC gets, you know, I think the budget for the BBC was like $6 billion, you know, in 2016 or 2017.
Wow.
The CBC, on the other hand, gets about $3 billion. But a good chunk of their money comes from straight advertising. And they don't call it underwriting like we're forced to do here in the United States. It's advertising. And so...
can you give us kind of a quick... I know you said that underwriting is really another word for advertising, but what's the legal distinction, if there is one?
Well, in the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, one of the things, and a lot of other networks also have their own guidelines that distinguish between underwriting and advertising. And basically, the difference between an ad and underwriting is that underwriting cannot have action steps. So there can't be anything that says, call now. And also, there can't be any reference to price, like this thing costs, you know, $49.95 or something like that. And of course, advertising can do all that stuff, which is becoming a point of a contention between public radio and commercial radio, because commercial radio is starting to lean toward its own version of pledge drive. But what commercial radio offers is links to special content, special interviews, special contests and prizes that you get if you call in and pledge. So public radio is really not happy that commercial radio is taking a page from their playbook, but public radio has never been able to advertise.
And by law, they can't.
And by law, they can't. Because the government did not want commercial radio competing with public radio. The government didn't want public radio competing with commercial radio, primarily because public radio is nonprofit tax exempt. And if a nonprofit entity is competing with a commercial entity without paying the same kinds of taxes and without being restricted to the same kind of legal requirements, then it's an unfair playing field. And so that's why Congress made it so that public radio could not advertise.
And that goes back to that Public Radio Act of 1967?
Yes.
Huh. Now, again, at this point, it'd probably be good to explain the difference between, we've used the term public radio, and we know that's not just NPR, and community radio, a station like KABU, where NPR or public radio station would be more like OPB. I'm not sure about all community radio stations, but I know at KABU I've been told that about 80% of our funding comes from listeners. You mentioned public radio. It's half that, about 40%. Now, KABU also gets some funding from underwriters, but generally not the big guys, the big corporations. And big government. For example, KABU has Tom Dwyer Automotive and Grendel's Coffee Shop across the street, while OPB has the ExxonMobil Corporation. So I was wondering, what's the influence then? When you would consider, say, OPB or an NPR station, independent media, it's not quite independent because they are beholden to those underwriters. And you mentioned the DuPont issue with Newton's Apple. That was a TV show.
Yeah, this is one of the things that's really at the center of public radio support by corporations and foundations. And public radio will tell you all day long that they are not influenced by the money that they get. And that's what they say. And I'm not going to say that they are telling a purposeful untruth. But there is plenty of evidence that shows that although they may not make their decisions based on who gives them money, the consideration of who gives them money has a lot to do with how they end up doing a lot of what they do. And you really have to dig around to find it.
Here's something I heard, and I don't really have the information or the data to back it up, but given the underwriting of ExxonMobil for NPR, somebody told me that that's why you don't hear any anti-fracking stories on NPR News. Is that true? Or?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you would have to go through NPR's archive to see if there are any anti-fracking stories.
I certainly haven't heard any. I've been listening for several years now since somebody told me that.
Well, the best way to check that would be to go through the archive.
Oh, okay.
You know, and also, you know, the individual stations, they may do their own fracking stories, and they are NPR affiliates. So it's not like NPR is not doing a fracking story just because you don't hear it on the network. Mm-hmm. But there, like I said before, there are lots of examples where someone could certainly question whether or not a funder or a contributor has had any influence over how a story is reported, how often a story is reported, or what the content of that story is.
And it's not just the, clear from the book, not just the underwriters and big government, but diversity in programming, say, is a big difference between public and community radio.
Yes.
I know there's not quite any other station like KABU where diversity is a kind of part of our charter, our mission. Now, NPR, and you say this in the book, gets most of their listener funding from wealthy white listeners. And that has some influence on the programming. You talk in the book about...
Well, I wouldn't say most. I say about probably $3 out of every $10 of NPR's money comes from people who are of a certain demographic category, okay? A lot of the money that NPR gets are from one-time donors, individual donors, and I divide those donors up according to whether or not they're major givers, transactional givers, and, you know, givers like under $100, one-time givers and things like that. So NPR takes money from individuals in terms of their ability to give financially. So it's under $100, between $100 and $250, and $250 and up. So the major givers tend to be over $1,000. The transactional givers tend to be between $250 and $1,000. And, you know, most ordinary givers are $250 and below. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so getting back to your question, I don't know whether or not NPR is directly influenced by foundations and corporations. But as I said, there's lots of very circumstantial evidence that would say that it does happen, not only at the network level, but at individual stations.
What I was getting at, Don, was you talk in the book about NPR maintaining a consistency of tone. And that's, I have a quote here that I'll read that explains it a little bit better, but that helps them get money from the audience and keeps the audience happy, or their audience happy, or they think that's what keeps their audience happy. And the New Yorker called that voice, that public radio voice, mentholated. You mentioned that in there. And then you also mentioned a quote from the American writer Charles Bowden. Here's the quote: "The fabled NPR voice produced in some secret kitchen where ordinary Americans are dipped in tubs of soy milk, white wine, and herbal tea until their vocal cords lose all sense of desire, familiarity, or place." And I'm wondering, this consistency of tone is not an accident. It's there to, why is it there? I describe it as bland. To me, public radio is, for the most part, fairly bland compared to, say, community radio. Obviously, I'm very biased about that. So what is the purpose of that consistency of tone that they're, even the way they do an audio documentary, it seems to be a formula?
It's sort of like, it's sort of a similar question as to why is the McDonald's menu the same from coast to coast?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's because that's how you get the most people. You find something that that appeals to the largest number of people, and you keep doing it. And NPR has found it, public radio... I would have to say NPR, because different public radio present their stories in different ways. NPR has found a formula that works in terms of the way they talk, in terms of who talks, in terms of you know, how the formula is set up for stories. There's a section there about sports and...
Yeah, sports and music, you mentioned, are both not really covered that well.
The quote I wanted to mention about sports is how one of the guys, I think he was speaking for The Dis, one of the podcasts that talk about sports, he was talking about how NPR can't really do anything else, you know, about how, you know, every story for NPR has to be, I talked with blah, blah, president of blah blah at blah blah university, and he said blah blah. It's like that's basically the formula.
You just fill in the blah blahs.
Just fill in the blah blahs, and I think that's probably why. I mean, they know what works for the largest number of people. Although that may be shifting for the millennial audience. There is another existential problem that NPR is having, is that the way they have been telling their stories for decades is being shifted by the millennial audience. And, you know, along with that shift come a whole bunch of new elocutions in the ways people speak. Like you and I are speaking without a lot of vocal fry, without a lot of uptalk, without a lot of the kind of speaking styles that you hear on public radio.
I know what you're saying when you're talking about uptalk. I think it goes something like that, and that would be a younger generation that does that.
And I hear a lot of people speaking, you know, with vocal fry.
That's the vocal fry.
Vocal fry is very, very commanding.
And you also mentioned in the book that the boomer audience for NPR, for public radio, is decreasing, and the millennial audience is increasing.
Yes, yes. But the millennial audience is increasing primarily through devices. So there again, we're going back to the fact that a lot of the programming that people have been used to getting through their antenna for years, those affiliate stations, are scrambling to have podcasts and to create apps and to have second streams on their frequencies so that they can deliver content digitally, because people just aren't listening as much through their radio, through their desk tabletop radio, or through the antennas they used to. They're still listening. Pew says that probably 90% of people are still listening to at least a few hours of radio a week, but that number
terrestrial radio,
yeah. Right? But that number has been consistently falling over the years.
And the numbers of people are listening through their smartphone apps, through
their
podcasts,
laptops,
however
right.
they get it, is increasing.
Is increasing,
and
right.
will continue. Mm-hmm. Those will go in opposite directions yes. over the next few years. Now, another huge difference between public and community radio, at least KABU community radio, is executive pay. You write in the book that the CEO of WHYY in Philadelphia, which is the home station for Terry Gross's Fresh Air, he made over $840,000 in 2017. And Willamette Week just reported that the current president and CEO of OPB, that's Steve Bass, here in Portland, collected over $430,000 in total compensation for the previous fiscal year. That might give pause to people who are calling up and contributing during pledge drives, don't you think? I'm going to look twice now at where this guy's taking home $430,000 a year, and I'm giving them my, I don't know, $50 or whatever.
Well, you know, I'm not trying
to... How much is going to him, and how much is going to programming?
It's difficult. See, these are difficult questions, and I'm not trying to purposely defend public radio, but I do have to say that in one aspect... The salaries that executives get is sort of baked into the corporate cake. I mean, if you remember what happened in 2008, one of the things that Wall Street firms said is we have to pay these people this money or else they'll go someplace else. And one of the reasons why those corporations pay those people that money is because they pay them not only to succeed, but they pay them to risk things that could cause failure. So, you know, those people are under a lot of responsibility to make sure that they not only risk the organization and take it where it's never been, but they need to be compensated for that. Now, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that argument, because there's lots of reasons and lots of examples of where the corporations and boards don't have to agree with that, but they do. Another thing about those salaries is that there are a lot of people at affiliate stations who make money on a level of network CEOs, but they're running affiliate stations. And so you would think that, you know, if an affiliate station has a CEO and that CEO is making $400,000, and at some networks, you know, you have a network CEO making $400,000, well, there's a disparity there. The network CEO you would expect would be making $400,000. Maybe the affiliate CEO does not really add that much value to the network as a whole, so maybe they shouldn't be making $400,000. Maybe they should be making $300,000. And then getting to the whole idea of how much a person should be contributing. Well, you're right. I mean, if I'm sitting at home and I read a story in the Willamette Week that somebody's making $430,000 at a public radio station and I'm giving them $50 a month, I do have it does, and public radio speaks to that. They're like, you know, we have to believe that every dollar you give us, this is the mantra, every dollar you give us goes to support. Every dollar helps. No dollar is unimportant. So please don't feel that your dollars, your $10 or your $15 is not important. they're trying to make sure that that message is sent, that regardless of what our people are being paid, every dollar you give us supports what you hear, what you depend on. And then they always turn it back to the listener. You need this. You want this. You can't survive without this. So we depend on your money because we need your money to pay our people, to get our gear, to get the shows that you depend on. They always turn it back to you.
I understand that. But I take pause when one of their people is making $400,000 a year.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
And I need to pay that guy. But you've done the research and the data backs up what most of us think of pledge drives, Don. They're necessary interruptions at best. At their worst, they can be annoying to the point that listeners just tune them out. And you have this quote from Ira Glass, who's very big on public radio. He said, the pledge drive has everything going against it as broadcasting. It's repetitive. It's ad-lib by people who can't ad-lib. And I hear that all the time in OPB. It's about asking for money, which is something nobody wants to hear, even from their own relatives. So this is something we brought up earlier. Let's talk about some of the alternatives to the pledge drive. And one thing you were getting at a little earlier was pledge-free programming.
Pledge-free streaming. Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
The thing about pledge-free streaming is that the technology has been around since 2011, and it works like this. Let's say that you have an iPhone and you want to listen to OPB, but it happens to be when they're having the pledge drive. If OPB had pledge-free streaming, then what you would do is you would go online, you would register your device, OPB would recognize your device, you would pay to OPB whatever they wanted in order for you to have that pledge-free stream, and then you would hear OPB without the pledge drive. And so it's sort of like, you know, a penthouse versus a basement version of what listeners get depending on how much money they have.
Or going back to Armed Forces Radio that where they edited out the pledge drives.
Right. So if you have the money and if the technology exists, then you can. And see, there again, it's the question of, does public radio make a distinction to people who have money? You know, I mean, throughout the book, I talk about the distinctions that are made, you know, to people who are high income donors versus not. Public radio has a responsibility. It says it has a public charter to reach out to people regardless of what their income, regardless of their diversity, regardless of their location, regardless of their education level, and give them the same content because their job is to bring every American or every listener up to the same cultural level as a responsible citizen. But some people are more equal than others, you know, and I mean,
in the words of George Orwell,
and it just comes down to, you know, a bare naked fact that public radio relies on people who have more money than people who have less money. And so, you know, that's just the way it is. And there's lots of talk around, you know, how that shouldn't matter or how, you know, it's not important or how, you know, we do everything to mitigate that. But, it, you know, it is a fact that is a fact.
In a capitalist society, I think it's unavoidable.
Absolutely.
Now, let's talk about some other options. There are other alternatives besides a pledge-free streaming. I've interviewed many podcasters for KBOO, especially those who have no presence at all on terrestrial radio. And most of their money, if there's any at all, some of them don't make much or anything, it would come through crowdfunding. So there's websites like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, Patreon. Is that a viable option for public radio?
Well, public radio has relied on, not all of public radio, but NPR did a T-shirt back in 2008 in the wake of the financial crisis, and they expected to raise about $41,000 or $50,000. That was their goal. They announced the crowdfunding campaign for this T-shirt because they were trying to show how a T-shirt moves through the supply chain around the world. How is a T-shirt created? What's involved in creating it? And how does it end up, you know, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, if it starts out in, you know, in Vietnam? And so they wanted to show how it was made. And so they figured that their project would raise $50,000. They announced it like at the end of April or the end of May, in 2008. Within one day, they had hit that goal. And 10 days later, they had earned $590,000.
Wow.
On this crowdfunding campaign.
And that seems to go back, of course, with crowdfunding, so a little bit more technologically advanced, going back to what the guy at NPR did when he monetized shows like Garrison Keillor's was selling swag through those two magazines you mentioned.
Right. And for instance, Roman, I think it's Roman Mars, who created the podcast 99% Invisible.
Right.
He
has a whole network now, right?
Yeah, Radiotopia, right. Uh-huh. It's on PRX. He and Jake Shapiro, who was the former CEO of PRX, they now run Radiotopia together, I believe. And Radiotopia is like it's like 13 or 14 really high octane podcasts that help generate money for the network, not necessarily through pledge drives, but through reminding people, you know, of their obligation to pay for what they're hearing. But anyway, Roman Mars, when he was running 99% Invisible, also had a couple of crowdfunding campaigns and raised a ton of money. You know, 99% Invisible, I think, was also a child of Radiolab or WBEZ. I can't remember which one, but one of those networks helped spawn the podcast, which just goes to show how important terrestrial still is. Terrestrial radio is still very important in some cases to help a podcaster get off the ground. You know, and then once it's off the ground and it has enough financial support, it can run on its own and become a revenue stream for the terrestrial station.
Yeah, you mentioned an interesting example in the book, the podcast Serial, which is somewhat of a spinoff from This American Life. Its very first episode was broadcast on terrestrial radio. Starting with the second episode, it was podcast only, and it just took off.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, gave the people at public radio, terrestrial radio, some idea of the power of the new technology of podcasting, streaming, smartphone apps.
Absolutely. But there are tens of thousands of podcasts out there. And so for a podcaster...
Over 700,000, the last count on iTunes, yeah.
And that's just iTunes.
That's just iTunes, yes.
And so for podcasters to succeed, they have to have really an outstanding show or some kind of platform to get them out there, or both.
And that's where terrestrial radio could come in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have one last question, Don, and this would be more on the future of radio, and we're kind of leading up to this. We talked about the future of pledge drives, some alternatives to that, but what about the more general question of where public radio is headed, and maybe all terrestrial radio, public, community, and commercial, in the age of online streaming and these apps and social media and podcasts, not to mention a younger generation listening, then this younger generation listening may not have grown up listening to radio like we have. You have this great quote from the comedian Pete Davidson, who's on SNL, and the quote must have been from a routine. He says, "What is radio? Is that like a podcast?"
Right.
So where is that future going? Is terrestrial radio going away? Are we going to see it in 10, 15, 20 years and everything will be online?
Well, it's very interesting because I think it was in Denmark back in 2017, they eliminated broadcasting on FM and they went straight to digital. So they don't use their FM frequency anymore. FM is terrestrial broadcasting on the FM band, I think in this country. I can't remember which country it is, but it is over.
So wherever that country is, if I have an FM radio and I turn it on, I'm not going to get anything at all?
From that country. You may get something from other countries.
Oh, incredible. Wow.
The UK has also been looking at the idea of giving up FM broadcasting. And
what's the reason for that?
Well, because companies like Verizon or whatever their equivalents are over there, you know, when you give up those frequencies, when the government auctions off those frequencies, and we've had those auctions here, they're called spectrum sales. When the FCC auctions off in the United States, when companies make their frequencies that they're not using available, and the FCC auctions those frequencies off, they get money for those frequencies. They're paid for the unused portion of their frequencies, and then whatever they are using, that gets they're able to convert a lot of their broadcasts to digital, which takes up less bandwidth, and they get money for the frequencies that they didn't use. And so companies then bid on those frequencies for all of the Internet of Things stuff that's coming.
Ah.
You know, so all of the frequencies that TV stations and radio stations used to use, companies now buy those frequencies.
You have a new batch of customers for those.
But the problem is, it used to be that those frequencies used to be considered the public airwaves. Are they the public airwaves anymore? Now that they're owned by corporations,
privatized, yeah,
that can create products and services that use those frequencies. So that's one big question. As far as, you know, the future of terrestrial broadcasting, Vivian Schiller, who was the CEO of NPR until she was ousted, in 2011, 2012, she said that digital is going to be the future. And she made a quote that was something along the lines of, you know, terrestrial antennas will be lying in pieces on the ground someday, you know, someday soon. So, you know, she believes that it's entirely possible that digital will overtake terrestrial broadcasting a lot faster than everybody thinks. And finally, there are two women who have been in public radio for a long time. Betsy O'Donovan, who used to voice a lot of NPR's underwriting credits, and Melody Kramer, who has been a Nieman Fellow and done a lot of research on public radio and public radio membership and fundraising and things like that. These two women have written a piece together talking about how, you know, the only way to save public broadcasting, and this is their quote, is to blow it up and start over. And so their view is public radio probably needs to go into the open market, which is what conservatives have been saying all along. If this thing is so good, let's see how well it survives in the open market. What they say for television, though, they say PBS television is really good for kids. So CPB needs to relaunch PBS as a strictly children's only programming service.
And that's the Sesame Streets of the world.
Exactly.
And what used to be Newton's Apple, I guess.
But as you know, Sesame Street a few years ago went into a collaboration with HBO because Sesame Street was having financial problems. And so people who watch HBO get first run episodes of Sesame Street, and then it goes to PBS. You know, so PBS essentially gets the leftovers.
We're seeing kind of a hybrid now of public and private.
Exactly.
Huh. And exactly. Maybe that's where the future is going for radio.
Yeah.
And public television, I guess.
I end the book with a quote that I really think sort of exemplifies what the end of public broadcasting may look like if people aren't careful. I talk about how I was, you know, watching the PBS NewsHour, and I was really, really emotionally struck by, you know, the final closing credit for the NewsHour is the screen identifying the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and how much I learned about how much work public broadcasting does to inform us and how much it's gone through. But then I found this quote: Public Radio 47 USC dictates how public radio must handle underwriting. Seven times throughout the 2011 documents, subchapter on the CPB is the phrase National Public Radio or any successor organization. And it struck me that there could be a successor organization to National Public Radio. But then I realized that Congress realizes that nothing lasts forever. And I just remember how Air America went away. So people really have to take a responsibility in how they want public radio to be, what they want it to do, where they want it to go. And they can't just assume that just because their station is on the air today that it'll be on the air tomorrow. Because every couple of weeks, a station disappears, a station manager is fired, a staff is in uproar because of some crap. And people never know because stations want to keep all that stuff hidden because they want everybody to think everything is fine. And if that happens enough times, people will wake up one day and realize there's a lot of stations gone.
So if you want to see them stick around, you're saying support them.
That's right. Not only support them, but take a responsibility in how they work. Get into their business. Call the station. Visit the station. Talk to people. Don't let them push you off on social media. Don't let them send you the voicemail. Go there. Talk to people. And go to those community advisory board meetings that they're required to have to let you know what's going on. I mean, you pay for their successes and all the sweet things they say and all the good stuff they do, but you also pay for their mistakes. And so you should know how your money's being spent.
Well, Don, that's an important message. It's an important book and one I thoroughly enjoyed as someone who's passionate about radio. And I know a lot of people listening will feel the same way when they pick up a copy. Thanks very much for coming and talking with us at KBOO today.
Oh, and before you go, let me give you the website.
Okay.
The website for the book is pledgethebook.com.
Pledgethebook.com.
Yeah.
Don Merrill and Pledge the Public Radio Fund Drive. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Don Merrill, author of the book Pledge the Public Radio Fund Drive. You can learn more about Don and the book online at pledgethebook.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Don for visiting us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.